As I mentioned, we will be in 2 Kings chapter 3, if you want to go ahead and turn over there. We have been discussing the transition of Elijah to heaven, or to be with wherever God took him. And then Elisha kind of stepping into that role and becoming powerful ambassador for God in Israel and Judah. We're going to continue with that tonight. We're going to talk about some more of the things that Elisha did in what's listed in 2 Kings. Some of the powerful works that God did through him. If we have time, we're going to move, eventually we will, into two men who have very similar names, actually. In some spellings, they're exactly the same, but Joram or Jehoram in one king in Israel and the other one is in Judah. They reign at the same time. Again, we're going to try to parse this out so it's understandable to all of us, but we're going to run into some similar names and it can get kind of confusing in our head. And it becomes even more confusing when the Bible really doesn't parse out a lot of information for us. And so, but we'll do the best we can as we move forward. But as I mentioned, we're in 2 Kings, and we're looking at this transition to Elisha kind of being the forefront of speakership of God in the book of 2 Kings. And so we've looked at that again. 2 Kings chapter 2, we discussed this event where Elijah is taken up into the heavens in this whirlwind that looks like, you know, whirlwind chariot deal, where he goes up, and it's at that moment that you really see Elisha step forward. Now, as we mentioned last week, something kind of interesting at the end here. What is it that Elisha asked of Elijah? Do you remember that request he made? What does he ask for?
A double portion of his spirit.
Yeah, and so we discussed last week, that could mean some different things. I'm not hard-lined in one particular interpretation. I maybe have an opinion about it, but it's hard to know exactly, at least for me, to pinpoint what he meant by that, whether that is the Holy Spirit working through him, or whether it was a personal characteristic of bravery or courage. But whatever it is, it's a big request, because Elijah says that, doesn't he? He says, what you ask of me is a hard thing. But it is interesting that we have a lot written about Elisha, and some of the things he did are just, they're just kind of awe-inspiring. I mean, it's kind of an amazing thing. And so we're going to continue with that. One of the things we talked about last week, in kind of bringing that whole series of events of Elijah traveling, Elisha following him, is after him ascending to heaven, Elisha goes back across the water in the same, almost the same way that Elijah did when he separated the waters. And to me, kind of it's kind of like a bookend that kind of closes that segment of events up. And so we looked at that last week there in chapter 2. We also noted the event that happened with these young men, these irreverent boys, who were acting in a very irreverent behavior, and how they were cursed by the word of Elisha. Okay, and so that moves us into chapter 3, and that's where I want to pick up this evening. So if you go to, we're going to come back and cover 1 through 3 in detail, but I just want to read it just to kind of get us where we are. When we come back to talk about Jehoram, we'll discuss this in more detail. But it says, in the 18th year of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, Jehoram, the son of Ahab, became king over Israel in Samaria. And he reigned 12 years. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, though not like his father and mother. Now, who's his father and mother?
Ahab and Jezebel.
And so, we'll
come back to him later, but I just want to note that.
So that's his parents. This is their son, Jehoram. He did, it says he put away the pillar of Baal that his father had made. Nevertheless, he clung to the sin of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which made Israel to sin. He did not depart from it. And so that's just kind of the atmosphere going on in Israel at the time. Things may be a tad bit better with Jehoram. Not great, but it's still a very unsettled time going on. Now, I wish I had the map up here, but Israel has had a tenuous relationship with its neighbors. It's often fought with Syria and some of the other countries around it. And we'll note as we go forward, Syria becomes a real thorn in the side of Israel, causing it much pain. And so you go on to verse 4, you've got another country, Moab. Now it says, Misha, king of Moab, was a sheep breeder, and he had to deliver to the king of Israel 100,000 lambs and the wool of 100,000 rams. Okay, that's what he was doing during the time of Ahab. But verse 5 tells us that when Ahab died, what did the king of Moab do?
He rebelled,
right?
As long as
Ahab was king, he kind of stayed in line with what the king, what Ahab wanted him to do. But as soon as Ahab was out of the picture, he said, I'm not going to do that anymore. And so he rebels against Israel. And so what is what's the king's reaction, the king of Israel's reaction? What does Jehoram do? Verse six tells us that he marched out of Samaria at that time and mustered all Israel. And he went and sent word to Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, the king of Moab rebelled against me. Will you go with me to battle against Moab? Sound very familiar?
Sound like another
series of events that we read about with Ahab and Jehoshaphat. And it got him into trouble. Well,
here it happens again.
Jehoshaphat agrees to do this. And we'll get more into the detail of this later, but I just want to set the picture. So they decide to go to war, and they go through Edom. Okay, and so they not only does he get Jehoshaphat and Judah to go along with it, he also gets Edom involved in this. In this event, and they decide to go to war against Moab. So, what did Jehoshaphat do the first time when Ahab wanted to go to war? Before they went to war, what did Jehoshaphat say? What did he ask for? Yeah, he said, is there not a prophet that we can go inquire of the Lord? He does the same thing here. Jehoshaphat sticking to his character. And so he asked that. Now, who's the prophet this time that comes? Elisha, right? Elisha. And so they seek out Elisha. And if you go in the text there, and you go to verse 13 and following, what's Elisha's response to this inquiry? Interesting. What does he say?
What have I to do with you?
Why are you coming to me? Right. It's like this attitude of, when I need something, I go to God and I ask him for help. But when I don't need him, I push him away. It's kind of like sometimes our kids do to us, right? When they need something, when they get into trouble, and they can't find another way out, they may come to their parents and say, hey, I really need your help here. I have no way. But then when things are going well, it's like, you know, I don't need you right now. And so Elisha says, why are you coming to me? I'm kind of paraphrasing.
That's kind of what he says. Why are you coming to me?
And at first, it almost seems like he's not going to do it. Like he's not going to get involved. But he does make the statement
at the end of verse 14.
He says, as the Lord of hosts lives before whom I stand, were it not that I have regard for Jehoshaphat,
the king of Judah, I would neither look at you nor see you.
So because Jehoshaphat's involved, this is one of those times when it paid off for the king of Israel to get Judah involved.
And so
he says, okay, I'll intervene
for you here.
Verse 15 tells us that he asked for a magician to come out and to play. Really kind of fascinating. Sometimes what Elisha does, it's just interesting. Like he does things kind of, I don't know. And I don't know if awkward is not the right word, but in an unexpected way. And so he begins to play, verse 15, and what happens? The hand of the Lord came upon him. And I imagine, so I've tried to read this, and I think what it's saying is that it comes upon Elisha, not the magician. And he says, thus says the Lord, I will make this dry stream bed full of pools. For thus says the Lord, and you shall see no wind or rain, but this stream bed shall be filled with water, so that you shall drink, you, your livestock, and your animals. So first what God does is he gives them nourishment. So he provides,
almost think about the children
of Israel wandering in the desert, right? God providing manna or water from rocks. So God says, I'm going to put
enough water in the stream bed
so that you can drink.
And then he goes on, he says, verse 18, this is a life thing in the sight of the Lord. What does he mean by that?
Okay, this is when I ask, you know, I'll give you a little bit of feedback.
Well, I mean, he's God. Putting a little water in a stream bed is not really earth-shattering to, you know, the God of the universe.
Would we be amazed to see water do that?
Well, yeah, we would.
But we would, right?
It's just, this is what I do.
I almost think about, we've been studying John chapter 1 in our Thursday morning class. And when Nathanael comes to Jesus, do you remember what he says about Jesus there? He says, can anything good come out of Nazareth? And then as they're approaching, as Jesus sees him, do you know what Jesus calls out to him? All right, if you're in my Thursday morning class, y'all are in trouble.
He says, there's somebody that has no guile.
Yeah, a truly a trustworthy man who there is no guile or dishonesty in. In other words, what he's saying is, he just tells the truth. He's a straight talker, if you will. And then Jesus says to him, before Philip spoke to you, I saw you under the tree. And Nathanael is like taken back by it. He's like, whoa, whoa. And he like has a whole transformation in his
response to Jesus.
And he calls him teacher and rabbi. And I believe he even calls him son of God. And then what's Jesus' response to him after that? May I have that? What does he say? John chapter 1.
You're going to see a lot more amazing things than this, basically.
Yeah. He says, this little, I'm paraphrasing, but basically, this little thing that I tell you I saw you before under the tree, you believe? Oh, you're going to see much greater things. You're going to see angels ascending and descending from heaven. And so, you know,
it's interesting sometimes what it takes for people to have faith. You know, what affects
one person or the other. And so God, though, being who he is, I mean, he's all powerful. And I almost think sometimes what he's saying to us is, don't you understand how powerful God really is? Don't you really understand that? And maybe as Christians, sometimes we take for granted how powerful God is and what he can do.
And so
Elisha says, this is a light thing for God to provide water for you. Now, what he's not saying is you shouldn't have respect for it and honor what he's doing, but understand how powerful God really is. And then he goes on back in 2 Kings chapter 3, and he says, he will also give the Moabites into your hands, and you shall attack every fortified city and every choice city, and shall fell every good tree, and stop up all the springs of water, and ruin every good piece of land with stone. So not only are they going to stop this rebellion, but they're going to go further into punishing the Moabites for their rebellion. To the point where they're even going to God's going to discipline them through the destruction of some of their property. And so pretty kind of amazing thing. As you read on, that's exactly what happens. You go down to verse 21. The text tells us when all the Moabites. Let me back up verse 20. The next morning, about the time of offering. Do you all know what time that is? The time of offering. This is an important time for Israelites, for Jews, for Hebrews. When's the time of offering, the first offering? Acts chapter 2. What does Peter say? They accused him of being drunk. He says, we're not drunk as you suppose, seeing how it's only third hour of the day. What time is that? An hour understanding of time. 9 in the morning. So this is early morning. About 9 in the morning. That's when they would offer 2 offerings during the day, right? Or 3 offerings. They'd offer one at 9. No, it's 2, right? They'd offer one at 9 and then one at 6. So 2 periods during the day. Or was it 3?
Oh, I'm going to go back and research the second.
Is it 3 or 6? Is one of those.
Anyway, the first one was at 9
in the morning. And so he tells us exactly what's going on here. So it's about 9 in the morning. Behold, water came from the direction of Edom till the country was filled with water.
So God let loose this water for Israel and Judah and Edom.
Now, what's the significance of accounting the time of offering? Is there a significance to that? Why include that? I won't get on you. Any opinions? Well, I mean, isn't there a connection with offering to God and then receiving from God? Right? Is he trying to make that connection? This is the normal time of offering. This is when you would offer to God. Well, at the same time, what's God doing? He's offering you. That's exactly right. Good job.
And so there's that connection there between those two things. And so the water comes.
This also is a confirmation, isn't it? What's it a confirmation of to the people? Answered prayer, right? This is exactly what Elisha said. It's happening just like he said. This is a you ever pray for something and just ask God for confirmation that he's heard you? Now, God, does he act in the same way that he does here? No, it's different. God acts through providence now. But wouldn't it be nice sometimes, or you ever send an email? Anybody ever do this? Do you on your email put a confirmation request?
When it's important.
When it's important. Why do you want that?
To make sure they receive it.
You ever send a text message? Does your phone do this where it says delivered? You ever look for that? Why do you want that? Make sure they got it, right? That they read it. And you especially want that if it's something important. If we call and make a hotel reservation, what does the front desk give us?
Confirmation. I'm making up words.
Confirmation number. And so God confirms that he's heard them. So verse 21, when the Moabites heard that the kings had come up to fight against them. So they finally get news that now Israel has responded to their rebellion. And so they all put on their armor from the youngest to the oldest. So they go up. They draw up at the border of Moab and Edom. And when they rose early in the morning and the sun shone on the water, the Moabites saw the water. And this is interesting. So what did God just do? He brought the water. God's got a dual purpose for that water, doesn't he? So he's brought the water in. The Moabites come up and they see it. What did they see? What? Yeah. Whose blood do they start thinking it is? Who's right ahead?
What do they think it is?
They think that Israel and Judah and Edom have all fought one another. And it's been so bloody, the blood's come down like water. And they're like, well, this is going to be easy today. You know, we're going to win this one. They can kill themselves. You know, and what's interesting is, isn't God just done some similar things to this just recently in delivering the people? Where he used enemies to fight against one another. And on one occasion, God says, I want you to know that the battle's not yours, it's mine. And I'm going to show you. And so he has the two enemies fight against one another. They defeat each other. And all the people of Judah have to do is come in and take the spoils. Fascinating, isn't it? Well, here you got the Moabites come up. Somehow that water, I don't know how that sun reflection, but somehow that sun reflecting off of it made it look like blood. And so they're like, yes, we're going to win this. And they say in verse 23, this is blood. The kings have surely fought together, struck one another down. Now the end of Moab, to the spoil. You hear that cheer. And they're all racing across with glee. You ever think you won something? Or you have an advantage somewhere? And you find out it's not what you thought it was. All right.
You mean like the promises I got from Bumpster's Clearinghouse?
Yeah. You're a winner!
Next week.
All we need you to do is subscribe to all these magazines and enter your name, and we're sure you're going to be a winner. Right? And so that's deflating. You ever get the false check in the mail?
For $5.
Yeah. Loan companies will send you that check. I mean, you know how checks look differently. Like when you're getting a reimbursement check from work, and checks have that green or blue kind of background to them. Loan companies got pretty smart habit. They'll send you that, and it looks just like it. But then you got to read that little fine print. Not a real check.
payable to the, you know.
Or you put it in the, put it in your bank, and then they get your information.
Yeah, they got little tricks, right? So
they think
we won
24, but when they
came to the camp of Israel, the Israelites rose and struck the Moabites till they fled before them, and they went forward striking the Moabites as they went. Who struck them? The Israelites struck down the Moabites. And they overthrew them, and they overthrew the cities, and on every good piece of land, every man threw a stone until it was covered. Interesting detail, isn't it? I love where we live. We're very blessed. But I will tell you, in trying to plant or cultivate our property, it's a very difficult process. Do you know why? Number one, our soil is not good. Number two, there are rocks all through. I'm convinced that there was a granite mine right there that they just covered up with a little bit of dirt, about that much dirt. If you go that far down, you start hitting that stone.
Sort of like getting one of those checks, isn't it?
and so you know, you rocks and soil and trying to cultivate for crops, not good. They don't work well together. Well, what do? They came to the cities and they begin to throw those rocks on that land, and they fill it up and make it useful. You'd hate to be that Moabite coming out after everything's done, being like,
"Get the wheelbarrow, honey. We got a lot of rocks to pick up." So he says, "On every good piece of land, every man threw a stone until it was covered. They stopped
every
spring of water and failed all the good trees. Trees, valuable resource." Especially during this time, but even today, the trees are valuable. And so they're
able to go through, get all these trees. It says, till only stones were left at Kir Harseth, and the slinger
surrounded and attacked it. When the king of Moab saw that the battle was going against him. You get an image here.
You say and you wonder
why they record this
piece of information. But I think it's just to depict the mindset of the Moabite people. What does he do? It says he took with him 700 swordsmen to break through opposite the king of Edom, but
they could not.
So
their last route of escape is cut off. Then he took his oldest son, who was
to reign in his place. Now think about who that is. His oldest son. Now we've talked about it a little bit in here, but what does it mean to be the oldest son?
You're the heir.
You're the heir, right? Your oldest sons were prized, right? Very valuable to the family. Very important. I mean, this is the guy who was supposed to be king. After his father's reign ended, what does he do with him? Very sad picture.
He
sacrifices him on the wall to his Moabite God. And we think about the people who serve Moloch, remembering them putting their children into the fire. Well, here you've got a father who grabs his oldest son. We don't know how old he is. But he sacrifices him to his God. You think about maybe the atmosphere that must have been present on Mount Carmel when Elijah's up there with the prophets of Baal, and after they've been calling for a long period of time on their God, on Baal to come and answer their prayer. And you read that text, and what do you know? What's obvious about it is their actions become more kind of vehement, more desperate. They begin to cut themselves in some way to get their idol to answer them, which of course it doesn't. But desperate people can do horrific things. And they have nowhere else to turn. And so, sadly, he offers his son against the wall. Did it bring him deliverance? And there came great wrath against Israel.
And they withdrew from him and returned to their own land. And so that kind of ended the activities of the day.
Kind of a real sad ending there to those events, but
pretty important
for Israel's future. Able to fight back Moab and push them back, push back their rebellion. So
Elisha goes from there, and he.
One of the things you know about Elisha is he did a lot of traveling all over the place, just like Elijah. He would move back and forth. And
there's a widow who takes note of this.
Now, there was also a widow who took note of Elijah. Do you remember? And what was it Elijah did for her? Very similar situation. You have a famine in the land. What was it? He asked for bread from her. And what's her response? What's that? Is it? I've got enough for me and my son. We'll, you know, our plan is to eat one last meal and die. This is all we have. And of course, what happens is Elijah says, "This isn't it. I want you to go bake me some bread, and you'll note that you'll have plenty enough flour." And that jar kept filling up. It never ran out until the famine ended. So he. By just his presence with her and what the great service she did for him, God blessed her home. Very similar situation here with the widow. Verse 1 tells us, "Now the wife of one of the sons of the prophet cried to Elisha, your servant, my husband, is dead." So this is... this appears to be one of the prophets who trained under Elisha. And one of the interesting things is, I want to note that, we'll talk a little bit more about it in a minute, but it appears, from my understanding of the text, that Elisha really kind of opened up a preaching school. We have preaching schools, don't we? All over the place. And there were these group of young men who trained under him. And you'll know them. They call them the sons of the prophets. And they're always seemingly close to him. Well, here's one who has passed away, and now his wife is a widow. Now, being a widow at this time would have been a very difficult life. And there weren't a whole lot of options probably for this young woman. She says, my husband, and notice what she says, your servant. That's why I think it's probably one of the prophets of training under Elisha, is dead. And you know that your servant feared the Lord. But the creditor has come to take my two children to be slaves. That's a heavy price to pay, isn't it? And Elisha said to her, "What shall I do for you? Tell me what have you in the house?" And she said, "Your servant has nothing in the house except a jar of oil." So
there's this
jar of oil. He said to if I can paraphrase what goes on, she has this one jar of oil. She says, "Go get a bunch of other vessels, other jars. And I want you to keep filling them up." So she would fill one She would take the jar with oil in it, she would then pour it into another one, it would fill up, and then she would be like, give me another one. And so she kept doing this until she filled up every vessel that she had. And he says, okay, now you've got enough oil for yourselves and enough to sell. And so she's able to go and sell the oil and then survive on that so that her children didn't have to be slaves. Another kind of neat thing that occurs, not that there's a big deep biblical meaning here, a theological meaning, but just an important thing about the power that God had used through Elijah. And then as you continue to read, you get down to verse 8. Here again you see Elisha traveling. He goes to Shunem, where a wealthy woman lived. Okay, this woman, she has some means. They seem to have, some wealth. And so he begins to travel through there. She knows him, and she begins to offer him food and a place to stay. She goes so far as to tell her husband, let's build a room. Let's build a little Elisha suite on the house. They build this suite onto their house. I mean, just out of the kindness of their heart, right? And it doesn't appear that she is like intending anything out of it for herself. And so for a while he does this. He's staying there. And verse 11, one day he came there and he turned into the chamber and rested there. Verse 12, he said to Gehazi, his servant, call this Shunammite. When he called her, she stood before him. Elisha said to him, say to her, see, you have taken all this trouble for us. What is it to be done for you? So he basically asked her, how can we repay you for what you've done for us? Now, she asked for anything. She hasn't asked for anything. But he sees what she's done. He wants to repay her. He says, do you want me to go and speak a good word to the king for you? She's like, no, I just want to live my quiet life here. So she didn't want that. And eventually he finds out that she's childless. You've got an older couple that have had no children. And so he recognizes that. And so he says, okay, I know what I'll do. But basically he says, this time next year, you're going to have a son. You're going to be holding a baby when I come back. Now, what's her response? This is important for later. I know we won't be able to get there today, but I want you to remember this for next week. So remember this. What does she say to him?
Don't lie to me.
Don't lie to me. You ever had somebody promise something to you that you really wanted, but you worried it's a joke? I know nobody would be so mean as to joke with somebody about something like that. But you ever thought that?
Do not say this if you're not going to do it.
Your child comes up to you and says, I'm going to clean my room. You ever think, don't say it. Don't even go there because I know you're going to get my hopes up that you're going to help out. And then I'm going to go up there and it's going to be what it was. You ever give your children a job to do? And they've been up there for a while or been in the room for a while. And then it's all quiet for a while.
And they're like, I want to go see what's going on.
And you walk in there, and there they are playing on the floor, and not one thing's been changed. You ever done that? Come over to our house sometime. We've had that experience many times. All right, sometimes you got to be there with a whip behind them to get them to move. But she's like, don't lie to me. Don't tell me this. Don't give me this hope to take it away from me. Hope is a wonderful thing. Hope is precious, valuable, needed. But hope is also dangerous, isn't it?
Isn't hope dangerous?
When you put your hope into something and it doesn't work out, you know, if something good happens or something good maybe happened to you, but it's a surprise, you know, that's great. But man, when you hope for something and it doesn't happen, you know, I think about people who deal with physical ailments and there's some kind of treatment that maybe provides some hope. And when that works out, that's wonderful. But when it doesn't work out, how hard and deflating that can be. Hope's needed. We need hope. But hope is a dangerous thing sometimes. Especially when we hope in the wrong things. And so I think that's what she's saying. She says, don't give me this if you can't do it. And he says, it's going to happen. Now, as we end this, to prepare us for next week, this is important, remember this. What does he find a year later? She has that child. So that's a good cliffhanger. What's the rest of the story? So we'll pick up next week with the rest of this and finish up with Elisha, and then we'll move into the back to the kings and looking at them. Thank you so much. We'll be dismissed and then have our devotional in just a few minutes. Thank you.